from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In April of 1989, a white woman was jogging in Central Park in New York City when she was raped and brutally assaulted. Former New York Mayor Ed Koch called it the crime of the century. The writer and now filmmaker Sarah Burns says in the weeks and months that followed, a media frenzy erupted, one that was motivated by fears about crime, but also complicated by the country's racial history. Five teenagers, five black and Latino boys from Harlem, were arrested and eventually convicted of the crime. But years later, the actual culprit confessed, and DNA evidence exonerated the five. Sarah Burns has co-directed a documentary about the story. She says that this is really about not just examining the case, but trying to understand the broader forces that shaped its outcome. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a good chance you heard about the terrible rape and beating of the Central Park jogger in 1989. The story, of course, captured the country's attention. Not just the crime itself, but of course the five teens, the five black and Latino boys from Harlem who were convicted. The news created a frenzy in the media that played out for months, but it's quite possible you didn't hear the end of the story. The fact that more than 10 years after the teens were convicted and most had served out their sentences, the actual culprit of the assault came forward and confessed. DNA evidence exonerated them. Their cases were dismissed. Sarah Burns has been studying the case for years now. She wrote an academic thesis about it. She published a book about it. And now she's made a film. It's called The Central Park Five. And today in the program, we're talking about it as part of our documentary series called Through the Lens. The film reexamines the case, but really what Sarah Burns and her co-directors wanted to do in the film was what she called explore the broader forces that shaped its outcome. The fear about crime, the country's complicated racial history. In her book, Sarah Burns says there was one persistent nagging question that she was trying to get at. How did this happen? We invite you to join the conversation today. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The Central Park Five is directed by Ken Burns, by David McMahon, and Sarah Burns. Sarah Burns is the author of the book I mentioned called The Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding, and she's joining us today. From a studio in Keene, New Hampshire, in fact. And Sarah Burns, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
David McMahon also with us, co-produced for Ken Burns' documentary, The War and the National Parks. He was also producer and writer for The Tenth Inning, a follow-up to Ken Burns' film Baseball. We should mention this is a family project. David McMahon and Sarah Burns are married, and Sarah is Ken Burns' daughter. And David McMahon, welcome to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
And I should say next Wednesday, of course, we're screening the Central Park Five as part of our Through the Lens documentary series. It's a collaboration with the Utah Film Center and with this time KUED Channel 7. We'll give you details about that as we go along. So, Sarah Burns, I wanted to start with you. I mentioned your interest in this story, which really started, as I said, something like 10 years ago, and you had been working for this small civil rights law firm who were involved in this story. And you've said that looking into this, the film in particular, but the book, I guess, itself, really was kind of playing into what you had been studying in college about American studies. What was it about this story that really plugged into what you were already interested in?
Yes, absolutely. I was majoring in American studies as an undergrad and was really interested in particular in race and African-American studies, especially. And it was the summer before my senior year when I worked as an intern for this civil rights lawyer. And that's when I learned about this case. And it was exactly, it fit into everything that I'd been studying in American studies, focusing on race, even though it was a slightly more contemporary story. This crime had happened in 1989. It dealt with all of these same issues that I've been looking at throughout the history. And I was interested in how this story fit into that larger history. So I focused in at that time on the racism in the media coverage of the case, looking at the way that this animal imagery had been used to describe these teenagers, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys, and where that comes from, what the sources of this kind of thing. They were called savages and beasts. They were called a wolf pack. And it was so striking to me to see that kind of language in these New York City newspapers from 1989, this relatively modern time. And it was the same kind of language you'd see in the coverage of the Scottsboro Boys case.
Mm-hmm. So you've written about the story, as I said, the book, and now you've made a film. How do you think, because we'll talk about the particulars, we're going to absolutely work through the details of the story, of course. But I did want to ask, how has the film been different in terms of telling the story or conveying this message? How has it been different for you?
The film is very different, even though it tells the same story. It's all part of the same, as I've been working on this for 10 years, that began with this paper and then a book and now the film, are certainly all part of telling the same story. But the film gives us this opportunity to tell the story in a different way. We were able to interview the Central Park Five, and four of them appear on camera, one just in an audio interview. But it means that the audience gets to meet them and gets to know them in a completely different way than I can ever express in my book, even if I'm quoting from interviews I did with them.
Right.
And I think that that's hugely important in terms of being able to get to know your characters and relate to them and understand who they are as individuals, which is a really important part of what we're trying to do in telling the story. It's not just about telling the story. It's also about hopefully trying to humanize these people, give them a chance to speak for themselves, and let people get to know them a little bit in a way that the media depicted them in 1989 and 90, they were completely dehumanized. Mm. And so it gives us this chance to get to know them and meet them. And also, to the extent that New York City is a character in this story, just as much as they are in some ways, we also get to see New York and hear it and get a sense of what the city was like, which I think is really important in terms of understanding what was going on then.
Let me ask you how you define your role in the film, because you're not just a disinterested observer, it doesn't seem. I mean, in the book, you come right out and say that your goal is to tell the story and understand the broader forces, but also to prove wrong those who refuse to admit a miscarriage of justice occurred. Did that change at all in the film? I mean, did you take that same kind of perspective?
I think we did. I mean, we were always coming at this as journalists interested in telling the story, but you know, the convictions had been vacated. The district attorney's office had reinvestigated and found that they didn't commit this crime. And
right.
So while there are still people who claim that they did have something to do with it, the facts just don't support it. And we came at it from this perspective of looking at these facts, finding them to be very clear and unambiguous on that account. And so our interest was, how did this happen? We weren't going to create any false suspense about whether or not they did something we all know they didn't do. That wasn't the point. It wasn't a whodunit.
Mm. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about this particular film, about the story, telling him the story as we were getting ready for the show. And she said to me, she said, yeah, no, I know about that. I know about that. But the thing that she hadn't realized or hadn't heard about was the fact that that Central Park Five had been exonerated. It's like that part of the story, as I mentioned in the introduction, hasn't really gotten out there. And this is something you mentioned, we'll probably come back to it, but this is something that you do mention in the film. People don't know this part of the story.
Right. I think still, if you walk down the street in New York City and ask people, do you know about the Central Park jogger case? They'll say, oh yeah, that Wilding case.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the beginning and end of what they know about it. People remember it. It made a real impression. It was a huge story. But they don't know the rest of the story.
David McMahon, let's talk about, as Sarah said, one of the characters of the film, the city itself. Jim Dwyer of the New York Times is featured in the film. And he called New York City in the late 1980s this schizophrenic, divided city where you've got, you know, wealth gushing in, but it's also a time when crack cocaine had taken hold. Talk about the context for this story as it plays out, the city itself.
Yeah, the wealth that Jim, the city was making a comeback in the 80s, but the wealth was only being experienced, or the comeback was only being experienced in small pockets of the city. There were many other pockets that were still suffering the effects of a period of lower budgets that left all the social institutions in a state of decay. And And crack, as you said, was an important part of bringing down some neighborhoods. In fact, it was so bad that it actually fizzled out quickly because it just couldn't sustain itself. It was terrorizing families and neighborhoods. And so that's a kind of backdrop for this story. The other part of this is that there are a series of incidents throughout the 80s, these sort of racially charged crimes. And you have a mayor who wasn't really good at mending these sort of fissures between the different classes and ethnic groups in the city. And so, and they also, you know, they would happen and then they would play out in the pages of the paper. And this was also during the tabloid wars in New York. And so you were getting these sensational headlines. And all of this sort of reaches a head in 89 with this crime. Homicides are almost at their highest ever total. I think they reached over 2,000 in 1990. So that was also happening as well. And this all created a culture of fear. And people, you know, everyone knew a story of someone who had been pickpocketed. But worse, I think, even was the sense that it could happen to you.
Yeah.
And so I think that there was both a lack of skepticism on the part of the media when the police fed them a story that had a group of teens of color rampaging through a park. And it was not only a jogger that they reported had been attacked and brutally raped, but also a couple of other people who were in the park that night. And everybody was just prepared at home or taking these papers off the newsstand to just accept the facts as they were delivered by the journalists in the same way that the journalists accepted them from the police. And so, you know, all of this led to a rush to judgment that landed these guys in prison for a total of almost 40 years.
Here's another element of context I want to talk about. I want to play a clip from the film. This is the historian Craig Stephen Wilder, who talks about how in this atmosphere, David McMahon, that you mentioned, there's a real sense of fear. And he describes what he calls the dominant social message. We'll also hear in this excerpt the Reverend Calvin Butts from the film The Central Park Five.
When the crack wars happen, all of a sudden, teenagers have lots of cash and guns. And all hell breaks loose in Bedford-Stuyvesant. All hell breaks loose in Harlem. All hell breaks loose in Brownsville, East New York. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid. But the people who suffered most with the rise of criminality, gang wars, drug wars, were actually the people we blamed. Most of the homicides were young, poor, working class, black and brown kids. And the dominant social message was, no one cared if you lived or died.
As far as I'm concerned, in the late 80s in New York City, the black community was under assault. The most endangered species in America, that was a popular phrase, was the young black man.
From the film The Central Park Five. So let's talk about the boys. They were boys, of course, at the time. They all lived, I guess, Sarah Burns, in a similar area in Harlem. Raymond was one who was new to the area, but they didn't really know each other. I guess some they would see each other in the neighborhood. But talk about who they were, because I think what's interesting is you get a sense that they were, I guess in some ways, as some urban kids are, they had a kind of street wisdom to them, but in some ways they also seem to me like kind of small town kids and pretty innocent and naive in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a naivete to most of them. You're right, they didn't for the most part know each other before this. Yusef Salam and Corey Wise were friends. They lived in the same building. And Kevin Richardson also lived in that building, and so they'd seen him around, but these were not a gang of friends by any means. Antron and Raymond didn't know the other guys at all. And I do think that they went into the park with this much larger group of around 30 teenagers. And so there were these sort of loose connections between them. But I do think that in some ways the reason that these five were the ones who became caught up in this case, I mean, the police brought in most of these kids who'd been in the park and talked to all of them. And it was these five who became the Central Park Five. And I think that had a lot to do with their naivete. These were kids who hadn't been arrested before, who hadn't ever been involved in the system, and who didn't know how to exercise their rights, didn't know to keep their mouths shut. I think there were other kids in that group who had been arrested before or who knew a little more about that, had those kind of street smarts, as you say, and knew how to avoid this kind of situation better than these guys did.
Let me play another clip here. This is Raymond Santana. I want to give people a sense of the voices here because they're obviously they're the ones that tell the story, of course. This is Raymond Santana, and I found this to be a really kind of poignant thing, and he explains really well about just sort of where they were, you know, emotionally at the time. Again, from the film The Central Park Five.
At that time, I was just getting into music, watching videos. MTV Raps was kind of big, so we watched that. We would record the videos, and we would watch them over and over and over all day. You know, my dad would come in the house and say, "You still watching that video from when I left?" You know, that's how far my range was. I think that I was at that point of coming into who I was, you know, but I never really got there.
David McMahon, that seems like a theme throughout the film, this idea that they didn't really get a chance to come into who they were. They were sort of deprived of that.
Completely. I mean, they were sort of experimenting as young guys. You know, they were meeting girls for the first time. They were, you know, the night of the incident, they were, you know, it was a holiday the next day. And so they were out a little late, but they all had curfews. They were supposed to be back at certain hours. They had parents who cared about them, in some cases, a parent who cared about them. But, you know, for the most part, the guys who ended up as the Central Park Five had safe places to go home to. And so really their futures were ripped away from them, and they had, you know, for all we know, they had great trajectories and were going to go great places. And it's a testament to them, if you spend time with them today, that they you know, they recovered and they handle what happened to them with grace, and they are doing interesting stuff, and more importantly, even, you know, they've embraced the role of a Central Park Five, and they can talk about it and try and keep this from happening to similarly vulnerable teens of color in the city and beyond.
Sarah, talk about the interviews themselves, because you've said the interviews, in some ways, they represented a kind of catharsis for these young men.
I think so. I mean, I had been talking to them for many years. I began interviewing them when I first started working on my book,
right.
7 years ago. And so over the course of working on the book, I interviewed each of them several times, and we had many follow-up conversations. And I think that was a part of the process that ultimately led to these film interviews that we did. I did some, Dave did some. But that by that time, they were more comfortable, I think, with the idea of talking about it. Some of them really hadn't done much talking about their stories before I started asking questions. And it took some time for them, I think, to get accustomed to it, though they all, from the beginning, agreed to participate. They wanted their story told. It just was challenging to figure out how to do that and to be comfortable with that. And I think that with the interviews for the documentary, there's a certain weight and significance to bringing a camera in the room that makes it different than the conversations I'd had with them before, where we're sitting in a coffee shop and maybe I'm taking notes or maybe a recording, but it's really different than when it's this is the one shot. This is your chance to tell the whole story, and people are going to see you and hear from you. And I think they all really took that to heart. There was a sense that this was an important thing to do, even if it was difficult. And they wanted to do it, and they wanted to be open and share their stories. And they were also generous with us in sharing those stories, in opening themselves up and being, I think, really honest and sharing something that was devastating to them, but which they all understood there was a catharsis in expressing it.
You spend a good amount of time in the story, because this is crucial, putting together the night that the assault and rape happens. And I wanted to get you to talk, if you would, about deciding how to piece that story together. There's a kind of pacing that sort of works its way through the story, and it's going to lead to a question that I hope doesn't annoy you too much, but it's about your father. Your father is Ken Burns, after all, and so I'm sure you're getting this question about what influence he may have had on the film. I mean, he is listed, of course, as a co-director, so let me ask you. There are moments when I have to say I see the influence of your father in some way, lighting concepts and some certain stylistic things, but there are other parts where that seem like real departures. So what was the give and take like, having your father sort of help you craft the story, but also making this part of your own if you decided that's what you wanted to do? I'm not even sure about that.
Well, I think we were really following the story here.
Yeah.
And the story dictated something that was a little bit different than the work that he's done in the past. All of his films in the past have used narration.
Right.
And this one doesn't. And it's because we did interviews with the five. We had from the beginning sort of hoped that we could avoid using narration.
Right.
And once we started doing those interviews with the five, we realized that they were in command of this story in a way that we could rely on them to tell it, to be the voices that could carry us through the story, and that we would need to do some work to make sure that the rest of the details were filled in and clear, but that ultimately the story was sort of resting with them. And I think there are stylistic differences too.
Oh, yeah.
Again, kind of dictated by the time and the place. You know, we're trying to depict New York City in 1989, and that's a little different. And the materials that we gather in order to do that are different.
Yeah.
We've got all this video from the 1980s, the newscasts, the music is different. And I also have to give a lot of credit to our editor, Michael Levine, who also brought a new and different perspective and ideas to how to shape this thing and how to create these montages at the beginning that help sort of put you in the time and place.
Sarah Burns is with us. She, along with David McMahon and Ken Burns, are the directors of the new PBS documentary, The Central Park Five, which premieres on PBS April 16th. As part of our Through the Lens series, we're offering a free screening this coming Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the usual place, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's a partnership with the Utah Film Center and KUED Channel 7. Sarah Burns and David McMahon will be on hand there for a Q&A immediately following the film. That event is free. The doors open at 6:30. If you need more details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a powerful and disturbing new documentary about a story that played out in the late 80s, early 90s. In 1989, a white woman was jogging in Central Park in New York when she was raped and brutally assaulted. The news captured the country's attention. Five teenagers, five black and Latino boys from Harlem, were arrested and eventually convicted. Now, years later, the actual culprit confessed. DNA evidence exonerated the five young men. Next week, we're going to be screening the film as part of our series Through the Lens. Today in the program, the filmmakers Sarah Burns and David McMahon are joining us to talk about the story, which is about the media, it's about race, and it's about how you find justice when everyone seems to be afraid. The film is called The Central Park Five, and we'll give you the details about the screening as we go along. Sarah Burns and David McMahon are joining us today from a studio in Keene, New Hampshire. So I want to play a clip that I found to be really powerful. This is of Kevin Richardson, one of the Central Park Five, and it's early on when the boys have been detained, arrested for this incident. There was a lot of mischief that went on. You know, people with rocks were thrown. People were. This was before the actual, I guess, assault had been made known. And the boys, Kevin Richardson gets really emotional in this clip, in this moment, because he's really frightened. He was 14 years old, of course, at the time, hadn't been in trouble before. And it's interesting to hear him just tell the story of how he was spoken to by one of the detectives there. This is Kevin Richardson, again, from the film The Central Park Five.
Somebody told me to freeze, I would shoot. My fear even went up more, so I just kept running. One of the cops, he tackled me. All my clothes was just all dirty and muddy. And he had a helmet, and he swung it across my face. And he handcuffed me, and I said, I basically said, like, what's going on? And he said, like, you know, didn't I tell you not to run? Like, you like you little animal or something. So I basically said, I didn't do nothing, you know. We sat in the police cars for a while. They rounded up a few people and we proceeded to the precinct.
I think all of them, Sarah and David, all of the young men have a kind of composure that seems surprising for what they went through. And they're, I guess in radio we always call it good tape, you know, because they tell these stories really well, but they also have a profound way of going about it. And it seems like every one of them did in this film.
Yeah, you know, when we brought them in to interview them, we were still, Sarah had mentioned before that the film doesn't contain narration, a convention that Ken Burns has used over the years in his films. That when we were hopeful that maybe we could do without it, but we knew that there were a lot of tricky things and that we would need to understand, like how is it that these guys could falsely confess to a crime they didn't commit?
Yeah.
That's something that a lot of people would understand. Why would you provide the details of a heinous crime that you didn't commit and didn't see, which they eventually were willing to do? When they sat down to begin telling the story, we were so taken by how well they had mastered what had happened to them. They seemed so ready to kind of report the details. I think that was in part because of the trust Sarah that they had developed in Sarah over the years of her work, and also because they had been ready to tell the story for so long. Nobody asked who they were in 1989 and 1990. The media rushed to judgment. They took the details. They were reported to them to the police. And so they were composed, and they had all this organized in their head, and it came out, you know, unrehearsed, but sort of, you know, beautifully put together. And we walked out of the first interview and just went, oh, you know, we've got a film here and maybe we don't need narration, because they really understand what happened to them, and they were generous with sharing both the details and also the emotional heaviness of everything that they suffered. And so we were grateful for that. And then subsequent four interviews, we sort of got the same thing.
Yeah. So the woman, the jogger, was discovered at about 1:30 in the morning. Her skull was fractured, lost a lot of blood, virtually dead. And then in the film, and of course in the story itself, the momentum of course shifts. As Jim Dwyer, the reporter, says, from this moment forward, everything plows towards these young men, these boys. How do you explain how the momentum builds, how things turn? It's as if the forces begin in some ways to take over this story, where, you know, temperance or reason or patience just kind of give way to a moment. Sarah Burns, it seems like that's what the film is about in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is, as you say, this moment when this goes from being, I mean, these kids have been brought in and arrested and their parents called and they're about to be sent home with, you know, appearances to come, I mean, tickets to appear in family court.
Yeah.
Right. This is not such a big deal. Right. And then the call comes in from the hospital that this woman has been found near death. And understandably, I think the police suspect these kids. This crime had taken place not far from where they'd been. Mm-hmm. They were already in custody. I mean, it's certainly a leap from the kind of things they were engaged in to jump to this horrific, brutal crime that was committed against the woman who came to be known as the Central Park Jogger. Right. But I do think it's understandable that the police turned their attention to these kids. The problem is that they became instantly certain that they had the culprits in front of them.
Right.
And so everything they did served this purpose of proving this suspicion that they had, rather than investigating and waiting for the evidence to come in and confirming those suspicions. They went straight into, and at this point they call in the most sophisticated, seasoned detectives in Manhattan to interrogate these children. And their parents don't really know or understand what's going on and aren't able to protect them really or advocate for them very well in those circumstances. And you get these detectives putting immense pressure on them and getting these statements, these false statements that admit to having witnessed and even participated in this crime to some extent. And then it's now sealed, right? It's like now that they have this information, it's really all the evidence you need to get a conviction.
Yeah.
A confession, right? These are foolproof. And so all the evidence that comes in later, DNA tests that don't match. No blood evidence on them, despite an incredibly bloody crime scene. Really no forensic evidence whatsoever to support this, not to mention the problems within those statements,
yeah.
Completely inconsistent with the facts and even within themselves. And those things are just ignored because everyone's so certain they have the right people that they don't really care that the facts don't fit.
There's another moment from the film. Saul Kassin, he's a psychologist who talks about this strategy of police, you know, and these are techniques, you know, good cop, bad cop, keeping them isolated, keeping, you know, playing one off of the other, promising if they cooperate, they'll be able to get back home, which really, you know, they're young kids and that's all they really want to do is get back home. Here's another excerpt from the Central Park Five.
Confrontation followed by denial, followed by you're a liar, I want to hear the truth, can go on for hours. And the goal there is to break the suspect down into a state of despair, into a state of helplessness, so that the suspect gets worn down and is looking for a way out.
And these kids, they're in custody. I guess in certain degrees of interrogation, some for 14 hours. Maybe it was Raymond, for up to 30 hours they were being interrogated that night. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, you know, and as Sarah said, you know, these were seasoned detectives who were using sort of well-tested technique to get these guys to confess. And, you know, they go in thinking, you know, they hadn't heard anything about a rape. They didn't know this had happened at all. And the detectives are slowly supplying them with the details.
Yeah.
And they're also saying, your buddy in the other room, you know, we know he did it. He's got the scratch on his face from the jogger. He's going down. You know, you better tell us what happened or you're going to be going down as well. And as they get broken down, as Saul describes in the clip, you know, they feel more helpless, and it's suggested that they're told directly that they get to go home. And it's all freighted with all the fears that kids of color might have when facing detectives from what they know about our history. And then the other part of this is that they have the truth on their side, or they think they do. So when they and their parents decide that they're going to give statements, and they eventually do that, they feel like, well, if we could just get out of here, and when we do just get out of here, then the truth will come out and everything will be okay.
Yeah. It's a fascinating part of the story. It's kind of a turning point where the boys begin then to construct the story that they know the police want to hear, and they start giving these details. And then after the detectives take these written statements from the boys, this prosecutor, Elizabeth Lederer, begins to record their confessions. And I have to say, one of the most powerful moments in the film, and I want to play an excerpt of it if it's okay, it's this young Corey Wise. He's 16 years old at the time. And he's sitting there, and maybe Sarah Burns, you could set this up for us. They give him a Pepsi, and she informs him of his rights, and he's really nervous, and you can tell he's ready to please. And I wanted to play a moment of this because I thought it was really, really powerful. It's the moment when he looks down at this photo that they've given him of the crime scene, and he's just horrified and terrified, and you can tell he doesn't know what to do, but he wants to please. You want to set this up for us?
Sure, and the other thing that's important to know about Corey is that even though he was at 16 the oldest of these kids, he had hearing problems and some kind of learning or developmental disability that had never really been treated or addressed, and so he's a kid who is just struggling to follow along and to make sure that he's struggling to communicate. And
right.
So this is how he functions in his life, is sort of, you know, leaning forward and nodding in agreement. That's how he communicates with people, because he doesn't always understand everything. He can't always hear everything. And so it's so painful to watch him as he's trying to please. And this is a videotape statement that is coming after hours and hours of him being broken down in this way that Dave was just talking about. And by this time, he is broken. He's ready. He wants to help them however he can.
Yeah. So we'll hear a little bit of that exchange, and then also we'll hear Corey later as an older man talking about reacting to that moment from the film The Central Park Five.
What's in that picture?
It's her.
Is that the woman that you saw?
Yes.
Is that sort of the way she looked when you saw her?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Did you see anybody hit her with anything but their hands?
saying...
And I'm telling you, Corey, I don't want you to think that you have to say that. But I want to know what you saw that explains how she got so badly hurt.
I did see Kevin pick up a small hair rock, and hit across the face with it.
Why did you tell him something that wasn't true, that you hadn't seen?
I was only guess just to save my own life. Get out of there as quickly as I can as possible, because I've been there too long as it was. And you know, being a kid, I never experienced that in my life.
How old were you?
16. 16, and I felt like I was about 12.
We should mention that Sarah Burns there talking to Corey Wise, that the other voice you heard. What did that tell you, Sarah Burns, about just the idea that these boys would be willing to confess to something like that? Did it say something, do you think, about just the fact that they were boys and they wanted to get home? Or is there something else there that it taught you about the way the system works, the way people can be manipulated, how you can be sort of brought to say something that you may not mean?
Yeah, it's this interesting thing. And when I started researching my book, it was the first thing that I investigated because I had to understand how this could happen. It's so irrational and illogical to confess to something you haven't done. And it's why that becomes such a powerful piece of evidence in a trial. A juror is sitting there thinking, well, I would never confess to something I didn't do. It's really hard to relate to that. And yet, it happens. This is not an isolated case. We know it's happened many other times. A quarter of the people who've been exonerated by DNA, by the Innocence Project and others, have had given false confessions.
Yeah.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And so we know that this happens. And it often happens in exactly the same way with these techniques, these tactics that detectives use, and this extraordinary power dynamic that is so imbalanced in that room, particularly when you're talking about juveniles like these kids who are naive about the system and who are so young, that I think a lot of that pull is just, I just want to get out of this situation. And the police can present it in a way that it seems that confessing, or at least telling them what they want to hear. I mean, these kids really thought that they could be witnesses, and that they were helping the police, and that they would get to go home. And they believed that. And that's often how it happens. And so we see it happening with some frequency. This is not just in this case.
The reporter Jim Dwyer points out in the film that there was something like 6 murders a day going on in New York at that time. And most people didn't really pay that much attention. But he says this one was different. David McMahon, what does he mean? This one is different.
Well, I think it's both the setting for it. You know, it happened in the city's backyard, in its playground, in the sacred space of Central Park. And so that was going to draw attention immediately. And it was also black on white crime. And I think that's sensational. You know, there were plenty of other rapes that happened in the city probably on that day. Certainly the numbers were high. There was another one that was reported on, but barely so. It was a black woman who was raped and then thrown off a roof by a black man. It got a very tiny little mention in the back pages while all the news coverage was swirling around the Central Park jogger case. And so I think it's the combination of these elements that made it a story that, you know, newsrooms rushed to get their heads around and then quickly report. And for 7 consecutive days, the major dailies in the city had headlines on the front page that had to do with this case.
The journalist Natalie Byfield is in the film, and she talks about how interracial rapes are covered differently. Let me play another excerpt from the film. This is, we'll hear Michael Warren, he's a lawyer. Natalie Byfield, as I said, Calvin Butts is in this, talking about how, again, interracial rapes are covered and thought of differently in this country.
I think that if she had been a young woman who had been found in an alley in Bedford-Stuyvesant, if she had been found in Harlem, if she had been found in any of the any of the darker enclaves in this city or in this state, Donald Trump wouldn't have spoken, he wouldn't have even whispered a word.
Interracial rapes are covered differently. And there was another major rape in the city at the time. And this is the woman who was raped in Brooklyn and thrown off a rooftop that got little to no coverage because the assailants and the victim were in the same racial group.
If it's a white woman and the accusation is that she's been done in by blacks, that by itself takes you back to Emmett Till, who did nothing but whistle at a woman and ended up in a shallow Mississippi grave.
If this had happened in 1901, they would have been lynched, perhaps castrated, and their bodies burned. And that would have been the end of it.
The term wilding is interesting. It comes up. You heard that word a lot during that experience. And the police say that's what they said at the time. That's what the young people call it. They're going to go out wilding. But it turns out that wasn't true. Do we know where the word came from? Sarah, do we know?
It's a bit of a mystery, actually. It came out of this case. Yeah. And as you said, it came from the police reporting to the media that this is what the kids had called their activities. And so people started repeating it as this thing that was a gang with violent intention sort of rampaging through public spaces. But there were a few different stories about where it actually came from or how it had been misunderstood somehow. One story that's been offered widely, which I'm not sure has any truth to it, is that the kids were in the holding cells in the precinct, perhaps before they knew what kind of trouble they were really in, singing the song Wild Thing by Tone Loc that was popular at the time. And that somehow was misinterpreted as wilding. Another one, which I think is actually a little bit more likely, is that the kids had, again, in referring to their actual activities, which were not as quite as menacing in nature as the one they were ultimately accused of, might have called it wilin', as in wilin' out, which was something that kids would say. It didn't have violent connotations. It just meant messing around. And that somehow that was misinterpreted and twisted by the police into this thing, which came to mean something very different.
Yeah. It's interesting. You say in your book, you point out April of 2010, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg uses the word again to describe this violent incident in Times Square. It hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't. And it continues to have that animal connotation that you saw in so much of the coverage back then. I think it's part of the why it's such a problem that someone would still use that word, not just because it was created out of a fiction, but because it implies an animal nature. And I think that that historically, since 1989, that word has been used specifically to describe minority teenagers. And that is further proof that there is an underlying racism to a word like that.
Sarah Burns is with us, along with David McMahon, and along with Ken Burns, they're directors of the new PBS documentary, The Central Park Five, which premieres on PBS April 16th. As part of our Through the Lens series, we're offering a free screening this coming Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Of course, this is the partnership with the Utah Film Center, and this time with KUED Channel 7. Sarah and David will be on hand for a Q&A. They'll be here. Immediately following the film, we'll talk with them. That event is free. The doors open at 6:30. If you want to get the details, again, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a powerful documentary called The Central Park Five. It's part of our documentary series, Through the Lens. We're going to be screening the film next week, Wednesday at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. The film is going to be premiering on PBS in April 16th, on KUED Channel 7. It's going to be premiering then as well. So as the story is playing out, a serial rapist has been terrorizing the Upper East Side, and he's finally caught in August of 1989, Mateus Reyes. And he's the actual culprit, of course, it turns out, years later that we find that out. And there's this moment which seems like, I have to say, such kind of serendipity. And it's another one of the turning points in this story. It's one day in late 2001, Mateus Reyes meets Corey Wise. They're both in prison together, the Auburn prison. And they had seen each other at Rikers Island, a prison before, and they had gotten into this fight. But then they kind of make up. And Sarah Burns, if this thing hadn't happened, this story would have had a completely different outcome. Let me play this clip first and have you talk about it, because it seems just absolutely remarkable. We'll hear Michael Warren, the lawyer here, and Corey Wise, and the reporter, Jim Dwyer, from the Central Park Five.
This was the first time they had seen each other since 1989, when both of them were at Rikers Island. And at that time, they had a little incident in the TV room, and it almost, you know, escalated to blows.
He said, "I would like to apologize to you. You know, we had a fight, Rikers Island, about the TV, so forth." So he said, "It ain't about nothing, man. We had. It's not gonna free neither one of us. Don't worry about it."
Reyes doesn't say anything to him, but he starts talking to people in the prison. "Hey, I met somebody who's doing time for a crime that he didn't have anything to do with, that I did myself." They send up an investigator and takes this statement. They send it down to the Manhattan DA's office, which has no idea that this case from 13 years earlier, which has long been stored and forgotten by everybody except the people involved, is suddenly going to come back to life.
And Sarah Burns, it does. It's such a remarkable moment, that happenstance, the fact that they kind of apologize to each other, and Mateus Reyes does the right thing.
It is. It's one of those things that you couldn't write if you were making up a story. It wouldn't be very plausible. But it is this extraordinary coincidence. First that Corey and Mateus Reyes had this encounter in 1989, and then that Reyes approaches him, and they have this really nice conversation. I mean, it could have gone a completely different way, and maybe Reyes wouldn't have been moved to confess after that. Or maybe Corey would have admitted his guilt in a parole hearing, as it had been suggested that he do, and had gotten out already. Mm-hmm. And then none of us would be talking about this. But in fact, they do have this meeting, and Reyes does come forward, and it spurs this whole reinvestigation, the district attorney's office. And we're talking about Robert Morgenthau here, who was the district attorney of Manhattan both in 1989 and 90 when this case was prosecuted, and still in 2002 when they begin reinvestigating. And to his credit, he decides to go back and really find out what happened. Yeah. And they look back at everything. They test Reyes's DNA and it matches. And they go back and they retest other forensic elements with the newer technologies. And they look back at the confession statements and see the discrepancies. And ultimately, the district attorney's office comes to the conclusion that these five guys clearly had nothing to do with this crime for which they'd been convicted.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you what you think this film and this book, and looking into this, what you learned about us, you know, about we as a public, how we react at moments like this. Because I got to thinking there's kind of a parallel here between us as a public and, you know, the potential mob. And those young boys, you know, being interrogated in those precinct rooms. I mean, we too are kind of manipulated, you know, tossed around by the circumstances, caught up in the coverage about, you know, the opportunity, you know, not taking the opportunity to kind of step back and really think things over. In some ways, we as the public are in the same kind of situation. We're really being sort of just tossed about. What did you learn about us, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's easy to want to place blame on specific individuals, and certainly you can do that in this case. But I think that it's also much bigger than that. And so it's not just the individual detectives and prosecutors. It's not just the reporters who wrote these inflammatory things and editors who decided to publish these headlines calling them a wolf pack, or the journalists who just failed to ask the skeptical questions that might have uncovered this problem sooner. But it is also in some ways the responsibility of the public too. All of these people who heard this story and who bought it, who didn't ask those questions themselves, and who were the consumers of this story. I mean, the newspapers were, as Dave said, competing for readers. And this story became such a sensational story, not just because it was a sensational story, but because it was a story that people, that sold newspapers, mm-hmm. that people were buying, they were interested in. It played on their fears, their assumptions. And as Craig Stephen Wilder, the historian, says in our film, sometimes we're just not very good people.
Yeah.
And I think what he's trying to say is that we all hold some responsibility for what happened here.
I want us to remember what happened that day and be horrified by ourselves, because it really is a mirror on our society. And rather than tying it up in a bow and thinking that there is something that we can take away from it and we'll be better people, I think what we really need to realize is that we're not very good people. And we're often not.
From the film The Central Park Five, David McMahon and Sarah Burns, along with Ken Burns, the directors of the film. It premieres on PBS, KUED Channel 7, April 16th. Sarah Burns and David McMahon joined us today from a studio in Keene, New Hampshire. And Sarah and David, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's all part of our Through the Lens series. We're offering a free screening, of course, coming Wednesday night, next Wednesday at 7 o'clock, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's a partnership with the Utah Film Center and KUED Channel 7. Sarah and David will be on hand for a Q&A immediately following the film. You can get the details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks today to Jack Keller and to Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.